Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly is coming to you this week from the Mayfair Hotel at the heart of the London Film Festival.
Get down, in a cup of fussy, get down. Trying to put a foot in at the red light zone, get down. Front and get them skull blown in a wild.
Alongside our dip into the cinematic goodie bag that is the London Film Festival, we delve into the deep grooves of Jamaican reggae and dancehall with a documentary, Made in Jamaica. Director Jerome Laperouse joins me. Zan Brooks and I won't be forgetting to review some of this week's other releases, including George Clooney in The Fantastic Mr. Fox, the harrowing tale of African child soldiers in Johnny Mad Dog, and Cheapest Chip zombie flick, Colin. Zan and I will also be comparing our festival notes so far, and we'll be giving you an insight into the labour and dedication it takes to get your film onto the LFF screens. Paul Thomas and Matt Harlock are here putting the finishing touches to the biopic of the great comedian Bill Hicks.
Chan down Babylon, as they say in Jamaica. It's a London Film Festival, Film Weekly.
Reggae music is life, you know? Reggae music is love. Reggae music is salvation. Reggae music is redemption. You know? Reggae music is prosperity. You know? Reggae music is righteousness. You know?
Made in Jamaica documents the legacy of reggae, Jamaica's blues music. Reggae, dub, and more recently, dancehall have turned the pain and struggles of Jamaicans into rhythms and songs that have travelled around the world. To tell us more about his documentary Made in Jamaica, director Jerome Laperouse has journeyed his way to meet us here down at the Mayfair Hotel and the London Film Festival. Bienvenue.
Thank you. Thank you.
Congratulations on your film Made in Jamaica. I have to say it's a very interesting way of doing it. You actually make a documentary in the laid back fashion of reggae. It's a very smooth film.
Yeah, kind of. And I have to say it's a kind of a feature film disguised into the shape of a documentary, you know. And instead of having a voiceover, you know, telling you what to think and what's going on, I decided to have a dramatic line, you know, which I would say a red thread, you know, like telling what I wanted to express through the lyrics of the songs and through the music. And I wanted to investigate what was going on, you know, regarding reggae music and dancehall. And that's why I decided to do a casting. And I did cast, you know, the most famous artists, you know, including like the reggae generation, which means the Fazzas.
So you auditioned Bunny Wailer and Toots. You had to give them a screen test. Those guys have been working for quite some time, sure.
No, I didn't do any screen test, obviously, but because I knew them before, but had to make some choices, you know, because I was not going to do a 10 hours long film. So that's why I decided to go to those guys whom I knew, you know. As you've seen, you know, there's Bunny Wailer, there's Tooth, there's Sir Third World, Gregory Isaac, Brett Salmon, and Sly and Robbie. And regarding the new generation, the dancehall generation, dancehall being a part of the reggae train, I took like Bounty Killer, Capleton,
Elephant Man,
Vibes Cartel, and the two women who are quite important, who are Lady So, who is a kind of dancehall queen, and Tanya Stevens.
You mentioned the dramatic thread, which is, I suppose, the fallout of the death of Bogle, who was a big dancehall star. And one often thinks about Jamaica and the current state of Jamaica and Trenchtown, and one thinks it's a violent place, it's a violent world. But your film starts with that, yeah, and then explores how we've got to there, and in fact the kind of contrary philosophy really that the music is and the general spirit of Jamaica is, and yet it has this violent kind of thread going.
Yeah, I think that your point of view is very right, because that's what I've done. But just to go back some years ago, my relationship with Jamaica started late 70s. And because we met with Bob Marley, and he saw my work, and at the time he's not as known as now, and we were supposed to do a film together, and took a little time, and then he went to Zimbabwe and get sick, so that's why I didn't do the film with
you.
Bob,
you were going to do a film with Bob Marley?
Yeah.
What was that going to be?
I was like kind of, Bob, you know, kind of Bob Marley portrait, you know, but because I was really very interested by what they were carrying in their songs. And because for me, reggae music is like, I mean, what is so special about Jamaica is that having been through slavery, you know, like 30 million, you know, people being deported, and some of them in Jamaica. So the reggae artists decided to tell to the world their own story, and like, which means slavery and what they went through, and colonization, and then they decided as well to speak about the everyday life, you know, like making social comments on the everyday life.
Mr. Gwenaman, think before you pull the trigger. It's me you really want for murder. Mr. Gwenaman, think before you bust the gun. If it's me you really come for shot down. I am feeling the same pressure as you. I am going through similar things you're going through. The tax increase, job decrease. Justice gone for a while, food mount begging.
What I really enjoyed, I have to say, was the subtitles, which you subtitle everything from the patois to even the words we could understand. You keep subtitling, and the lyrics. And it was a pleasure to actually sit down and listen to the lyrics of read the lyrics of No Woman, No Cry when Bunny Wailer was singing it, to re-look at the poetry of the words within the beautiful patois. And it really was absolutely a joy to read the subtitles.
Thank you. Yeah, because I mean. Yeah, it's a street poetry as well. I mean, regarding dancehall, it's a street poetry.
But what I want to know is about dancehall. I think that's the younger version of reggae, which I kind of don't quite know. I mean, growing up in London, one has quite a lot of dancehall as well, and the vigorous sexual movements of dancehall, the kind of, I don't know what you call it, the bottom movements, the wiggling.
The body language,
let's put it that way. This is the movement of a vigorous young man. Do you indulge in this yourself, Jérôme?
But I see it's very close to rap and American hip-hop. I mean, you can check and you can see how famous American artists are inspired by Jamaican music. For instance, you can see duets between, I would say, Missy Elliott and Elephant Man, or Missy Elliott and Bounty Killer, or Puff Daddy, for instance. You know, Puff Daddy did sign Elephant Man, and Jay-Z was having them on their, Def Jam, label. You can see Janet Jackson, you know, or No Doubt doing duets with them. And you can see Pharrell Williams, who just did produce the last Madonna's album, you know, with Timbaland, being inspired by Jamaican music. So it's like this small island is going through such excessive contradiction that and what is beautiful, that it, what they're going through, you know, the struggle for life and all that, is going through music, is expressed through music.
Jérôme Laperrouza, thank you very much for coming down to talk to us about your love of Jamaica as well. I think your enthusiasm comes across, but certainly in the film as well. Jérôme has kindly brought along three soundtracks to give away for Film Weekly listeners. What we want to show, who is on there? There's fantastic people on there. Toot is on there, Gregory Isaacs, Bunny Wailer, Third World, Sly and Robbie, Bounty Killer. Well, everyone we've mentioned there are there in Bright Away on the motion picture soundtrack of Made in Jamaica. All you've got to do is tell us a very simple question: who starred in the legendary reggae film The Harder They Come? To enter the competition, just email us film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. That's film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Entries must be in by Wednesday the 28th of October.
Go down on the ground, push your face in the ground. We all feel shame. We don't want you to see when me run. When me a run, when me a run.
Joining me now here at the Mayfair Hotel to review some of this week's releases and give us a little look through the festival so far, it's the Guardian film critic at large, Zan Brooks. Welcome to the London Film Festival.
Thank you, Jason. This is one of my first visits to the London Film Festival. It's kind of great, isn't it?
You see, the Mayfair Hotel, that's where the hub is. We've also got to look at the releases that are going around the country, Zan. So we're going to look at The Fantastic Mr. Fox, Johnny Mad Dog and Colin. Now, Fantastic Mr. Fox kicked off the London Film Festival last week. It now goes nationwide with its bushy tail. It's Wes Anderson directing the voices of George Clooney and Meryl Streep and Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray as those furry friends brought to life originally by Roald Dahl and now given the stop-motion treatment.
Master Plan, Phase 1, Side A. We'll start with Boggess's chicken house, number one. His only security is a few old hunting beagles and a low stone wall. Now, a word about beagles. Never look a beagle directly in the eye.
Why not? Beagles aren't so tough.
Yeah? Well, first of all, one of these beagles has chronic rabies, which he's on medication for, and if you get bit by him, you have to get shots in your stomach for 6 months. And second, listen, I'm not going to justify this to you. Just pay attention and stop interrupting me. I'm taping.
Zan, I said last week that I surprisingly liked this film, and you did too.
Yeah, I did. It's not an obvious meeting of minds, really. You've got Roald Dahl, who's the ultimate sort of patrician high Tory from the Shires. And then you've got Wes Anderson, who's the preppy East Coast aesthete. And I sort of imagine that these two probably would hate each other if they actually met. I think Dahl would have utter contempt for Anderson. And yet they do share the same quirky, wry, literate sensibility. So I think it comes together quite well here. I think that certainly it's as much a Wes Anderson film as it is a Roald Dahl adaptation.
Yeah, it's about families and sons and daughters and kind of, you know, the whole kind of group of oddballs that are collected together.
And also it plays out in a kind of transatlantic kingdom that's maybe three-fifths England, but then it has a sort of weird American Main Street. But you've also got the red post box. You've got the sort of neo-Georgian architecture from Bath in the background at times. It's a strange cross-cultural hybrid, this film.
It's part Postman Pat and part sort of Everyman America.
It is, yeah. And the animation, I think, is really good. And when I first started watching it, I thought this is going to pall after a little while.
Yeah.
But he does sustain it very well, and it does have that handmade, homegrown charm to it. You can almost see the grain in there, and you can see the fur sort of changing from shot to shot, like in the old sort of 1930s King Kong, the sort of stop animation, that gives it a very organic, and it's a contrived organic feel, but it is a nice counterpoint to all the sort of the pearl bright day glow landscapes of sort of Pixar and computer generated animation.
I like the animation a lot, actually. I thought that was the best bit of it. I loved the little clothes, the little yellow trainer of that kind of recurs. He always loves trainers and luggage, Wes Anderson. And in a way, when you said it didn't pall after 30, for about 40 minutes, I was sort of enchanted. And then I thought that the story didn't go anywhere, and he sort of undermines his own emotion, Wes Anderson. He's so laid back and ironic that sometimes you don't really feel anything in his films.
That's always the danger of Anderson. I mean, when I say that I didn't get bored of it, I mean, I didn't get bored of the animation. I think that you're right. I think that once they start tunneling underground and coming up different places, it loses a little bit of its charm and its focus. The other thing that I would say about this is I did really enjoy it at the time, but it didn't leave much trace. And maybe that's another perennial problem with Wes Anderson, that he makes these sort of airless, weightless films that are like little spells that you enter into his world and you think this is a wonderful little world to stroll around in, and then it's like coming back from holiday and it's kind of gone. You don't even have the photos.
That's Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's out on nationwide release this week. Let's move to another beast, to Johnny Mad Dog, a rather different tale from Wes Anderson's Fay concoction. This plunges us straight into the world of child soldiers in Liberia.
No arm is allowed to enter here. We cannot allow no one to enter this place with arms.
No, I can't leave my weapon.
You have to leave your weapon if you want to enter this place.
My weapon is my mother and my father.
I just told you, no arm is allowed in here.
That's a group of child soldiers trying to get into a UN-guarded hospital in Liberia. They're not allowed in because of their guns. I mean, this is one of the most intelligible scenes from the movie. The rest of it takes place in this extraordinary patois of French and English and violence, with swear words peppering as much as bullets. It's a quite headlong rush, this film.
Yeah, this is a harrowing, nightmarish war film. All the more nightmarish, of course, because the soldiers are kids. And they're kids who have literally forgotten their real names. Johnny Mad Dog doesn't know his real name anymore. He's a 14-year-old soldier. There's Small Devil in there. There's Jungle Rocket.
Chicken Head.
And something like No Good Advice, I think, as well. And so basically, all they are is killers. They're not even kids anymore. They are killers who seem fired up by the lexicon and the language of Hollywood war movies. So it's almost like this weird playground ritual where they talk in sort of gung-ho cliches. There's bullying, there's call and response chants. And it's terrifying.
It's that moment where he says, oh, I recognise this gun. It's the one Chuck Norris used in Delta Force. It's quite an extraordinary thing to watch. I actually, though, didn't feel anything with this, Dan. I just felt, wow, this is terrible, and all these kids are soldiers. But the film sort of continued in a number of sort of money shots of kind of almost pornographic kiddie violence, where they're coming over the hill in their truck, they're shooting, they're kind of, one kid's got to shoot his dad, the initiation ceremonies, chicken sacrifices. Didn't quite know what I was supposed to do with this material. Didn't seem to have any comment on the awfulness of the situation or any suggestion out of it.
You're right. He does, the director, debut director called Jean-Stéphane Soffer, does provide some angel to supposedly leading us towards a higher path, which is a 13-year-old girl who meets up with Johnny Mad Dog at the end. And there's a sort of parallel story of her wheeling her disabled father around in a wheelbarrow. And you kind of felt that this was maybe shoehorned in at a later stage to give it a little bit of resonance, maybe a little bit of light. But I agree, I mean, there is a problem with this film that a lot of the kid actors were child soldiers themselves. But maybe there's something slightly exploitative about it. And you're wondering, what are we supposed to get from this? And yes, of course, it's horrible. And maybe this is a story that does need to be told. And maybe it will reach more people in this sort of form as opposed to a worthy Channel 4 documentary. But there are still lingering issues that I had with it.
Zan, let's move on to Colin. This is a British zombie movie made for £45, which, according to the blurb, took Cannes by storm.
Come on, do you remember me? Do you know where you are? Come on, do you remember me?
45 quid. I was in Cannes, you were in Cannes. Did this take a spice storm? I never even heard of it.
I heard of it, but only in that little gimmick thing of, here's a film that costs £45, which I suspect probably isn't true. That's its angle and that's its selling point, as it were. I'm sure it costs more than £45, but maybe not a lot more, and it's not that great.
Yeah, I couldn't even see where they'd spent 45 quid on it, to be honest with you. I thought this was an absolute abomination. It's one of the worst things I've ever seen, except I couldn't even see it because it was so badly shot on some bloke's camera. Rubbish. This is the problem with the DV technology that allows people like him to get movies made and put in cinemas. I thought this was absolute Colin crap.
Well, it's nominally from the point of view of the zombie. Now, the fact is that a zombie isn't your most obviously sympathetic hero. So Colin just kind of shambles around in very badly lit interiors and exteriors with shaky cameras.
His mate's flat.
And his mate's flat, and his sister's trying to, you know, reawaken his dormant human impulses, supposedly.
Well, you got that. I didn't even get that.
Well, I think it's there somewhere.
That's Colin. Zan, let's look into the slightly more rarefied atmosphere of films that have made it into the London Film Festival. I've had an extremely busy time. I've seen a Jim Jarmusch movie called The Limits of Control, which I don't know if you've seen it. I think you would like it. It stars Isaac de Bancoli, who's always in Jim Jarmusch movies, Tilda Swinton. It's got like the best cast in the entire festival. Gael Garcia Bernal, Chaim Abbas, John Hurt. It's about as kind of African-American, I think he's African-American, we can't quite tell, assassin. We're not quite sure what he's going to do. He's going to go and kill Bill Murray, we don't quite know. I really recommend that one.
I'd like to see that. I think I've sort of fallen out of love with Jarmusch a bit. I think he's maybe a young man's filmmaker, and as I get older I find it all a bit too sort of mannered and stylized. But, maybe rekindle the fire.
It's the best thing I think he's done for quite some time as well. Saw George Clooney, he's everywhere. He's had three films in the festival.
Yeah, spread a little too thin, I think. Three films and, you know, they're not all great.
No, Up in the Air, which I'd heard good things about, is Jason Reitman comedy in which he plays a travelling kind of man who goes around sacking people in corporate America, and all he's really concerned about is building up his air miles on his cards. Didn't think it was funny, didn't think he was particularly good in it either.
And then there's The Men Who Stare at Goats, which isn't particularly funny either. It's based on a book by the former Guardian columnist John Ronson, so of course we're predisposed to like it because of that. It's a nice, wacky idea, but just doesn't really come to the boil.
Yeah, lots of people in comedy moustaches. I hated it, actually. I'd rather tear my eyes out than watch that again. I've also seen a really good Clive Owen film, surprising to say. It's called The Boys Are Back, in which he plays a sports journalist whose wife dies and he has to look after two young sons. It really resonated for me as a former sports journalist and now having a young son as well, though thankfully my wife is in good health. I thought this was Clive Owen's best performance, well, ever, really. And I think it's a year we've also had at the festival A Single Man, which Colin Firth won at Venice and has come here with Tom Ford. I think he's going to get an Oscar nomination. I also think Clive Owen's going to get an Oscar nomination. Two sort of long-cherished British actors who've never really kind of burst through into awards, and because they're liked, they're suddenly going to go, oh, I like Clive. I think it's their year, you know. I think we're going to see two of them at the very top.
Well, I hate to give you credit for anything, Jason, but you do have form in your Oscar tips. I remember Marianne Cotillard a few years back, you tipped her, so this is good news for Clive Owen. 400 years, 400 years, and a peace.
This year's New British Cinema section at the LFF is particularly strong. Last week we had Lindy Hayman telling us about her film In Their Kicks, and this week we've got Hicks, Bill Hicks, American. The Bill Hicks Story is the project of two British filmmakers, Matt Harlock and Paul Thomas, and they join me now. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's very exciting. This is before your LFF screening. You haven't even finished the film yet. What are you doing here?
No, there's a few loose ends to tie, but no one's going to notice. It looks pretty seamless at the moment.
It must be thrilling to have your film debut at the London Film Festival. You're working here in London, you're making it here in London, but it's an American story. Why are two British guys making a film about an American comedian, Matt?
Well, obviously Bill had a reputation and a following here, which many people have remarked upon, and he didn't go over as well in the States as maybe he would have liked while he was alive. So I suppose in some ways it's kind of apt that British filmmakers have stepped up to tell this very American story.
But Bill Hicks, I'm not a huge aficionado of Bill Hicks material, so for someone who doesn't know Bill Hicks, and I'm sure there are quite a few people out there, tell us why we should be interested in Bill Hicks, Matt.
Well, I think that one of the things that Bill did was that he spoke from the heart about issues that he saw affecting people in society. And a lot of those issues were to do with the way that the government or the way that religions or the way that big businesses treat people in society. And he sometimes was very vociferous and very angry about how he saw those people being treated, and he spoke out about it. And one of the things that resonates with people through the ages, it's still going on now, is that that lone voice makes them feel that they're not alone, that someone is actually saying what they're thinking, but has the balls to get up and do it on stage in a very, very funny way. So that's why he is still relevant.
I wondered about that too, you know, during the Persian Gulf War, those intelligence reports would come out.
Iraq, incredible weapons, incredible weapons.
How do you know that?
Well...
We looked at the receipt.
Very interesting style that you've used for your documentary. It's kind of an animation, if you like. I presume that the pictures of Bill Hicks that you use in all the different situations to tell the stories of his life were real photos. Was he an obsessive self-photographer or something, Paul?
It's interesting. There are around 800 really good shots of him, but there are also huge gaps. I think every now and again he took the opportunity to make sure he was shot quite well. But what we've done is replaced a lot of bodies with new bodies. So it may be that there are 24 very similar shots of Bill, and we've turned those into 24 new photos. So I think we give the illusion that everything was photographed when it wasn't, really.
Well, what's the style of animation? Because when I read it was animated, I thought cartoon. You know, I thought Michael Moore, he uses bits of animation. But it's not cartoon at all. It's kind of moving images using stills and a bit of Super 8. What's the technique here?
We don't know if it has a name, but it involves cutting out a photograph and then turning it back into three dimensions, which probably takes around a day to do 5 seconds. It's quite laborious. But now we're still looking for a name of how you might describe it.
It's Hicksian.
Well, the interesting thing is that we had a responsibility to tell Bill's story, but we also made use of the fact that as somebody who recognised that his voice was important, and a lot of famous people are known for this, they are quite obsessive self-recorders and self-documenters. So he not only had lots of articles and photographs of himself, but relationships he had with friends who were photographers, and there was a huge wealth of stuff. And we thought that the way to really bring Bill's personality and his relationships with his close friends who tell his story to the fore was to be able to use those photos and take people back to the time and place. And you're back in the late 60s with them growing up in suburban Houston.
You're obviously dealing with a life that extinguished at 32, so sort of tragically cut short, but you're going into his parents, his brothers, his sisters. Did you have to tread very carefully? Were they a very open family? Were they very particular about who they let kind of into this treasure trove of material?
I think the family took a long time to let filmmakers in, so I think it was 12 years. But once we were speaking, they were all very open, very honest. And we don't really feel like anybody held back, or even that time, you know, that they were painting Bill in a rosy light with the passing of time. No, people were very honest about what it was like and what it was like to be with him,
I mean, you're very surprising that people like his brother would actually say this was the time when Bill broke down and told me that his life was a mess and that he was going off the rails, and we'd expected there to be some reticence about them laying out some of the more painful and emotional parts of his story, but they really committed to the film, and I think they saw that it was an important chance to record a historical document of this important cultural figure.
Mm-hmm. Now you're playing at the LFF. What can you hope from a screening at the London Film Festival? Where can the film go from here?
Well, we've now got a six-month run before it's actually released here in the UK, so we're hopeful of getting to a few of the American festivals. Bill was huge in Texas, and so we're hopefully getting to South by Southwest and playing to the home crowd there. That's going to be quite special, I think, being with people who actually saw Bill in the flesh, and then they get to watch this film. So that's going to be another highlight, I think.
Well, you can see it in 6 months, but you won't be able to see it at all unless you go finish it. Thank you so much for coming and joining us here at Film Weekly. Go and finish your movie. It's going to be dripping wet, this print that they show at the LFF this weekend.
Well, you're a real stickler for us finishing this film, Jason. I think you're obsessing over that, and you know, luckily we're not. So,
thank you.
Thanks.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
American, the Bill Hicks story, is screened on Friday the 23rd of October and again on Monday the 26th of October, all at NFT1. For information, tickets and much more, go to the festival website. That's bfi.org.uk/LFF. You can also catch me on there doing a bit of BFI online stuff. But that's all for us from Film Weekly here at the London Film Festival. Do join us on Facebook, Film Weekly fans, that's us. We're particularly keen to hear from you if you've made it down to the LFF and find out what cinematic gems you've unearthed. Do share them with us. If not, pick up The Observer this Sunday for my reviews and, of course, the legendary trailer trash from the LFF. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. Get down, in a cup of fussy, get down. Tryna put a foot in the red light zone, then down. Front and get them scum.